geodesics of massive particles and massless, so things like bending of the sort of traditional tests of relativity, test bending of light by the sun and perihelion precession of Mercury. So the reading associated with these is in Wald's book, sections 3.1 and 3.3, at least for now, and then in Bernard Schütz's book, sections 5.2 to 5.8, and 6.2 to 6.4. I should also warn you a little bit that in both of these discuss the Christoffel symbols in from a slightly different point of view than the one that I'll be using, but only slightly, I would say. So the first topic is this, parallel transport and the and the covariant derivative. Okay. So sort of to approach this topic, you might think of asking yourself about the meaning of geodesic. So if you go back to flat space, or say Euclidean geometry, you know that a straight line, which is a geodesic, can be thought of as in two ways. It can be thought of as the shortest distance between two points on it, but it can also be thought of as the straightest, in fact, that's its name, as the straightest path that goes between those two points. So there's it combines two distinct geometric notions, which turn out to be equivalent, being straight and being short, or being an extremal of length and being something whose tangent vector doesn't change as you move along it. We've discussed geodesic from the first point of view as an extreme. Of course, it's not the shortest distance, as you know, in the particular in the Lorentzian case for time-like geodesics, it's in flat space always the longest distance, and more generally in curved space-time, the longest proper time, one should probably say, longest elapsed time. And in the case of a curved space, it may not always be literally the longest, but it'll always be an extremal. And in the case of space-like separated things, it'll never be the longest or the shortest, but there will still be the notion of extremal length. In the case of null, it'll be neither the shortest nor the longest, nor an extremal length, because the length is just zero, but it'll still be the straightest. So by being able to define straightest, we'll be able to write equations also for null geodesics. And it turns out that, and I'll show you this, I guess, maybe next time or the time after, that it turns out that although the null geodesics do not extremize length in any useful sense, they do extremize some sort of action functional. So you can still write down an actional functional that with a parameter m squared in it that covers both the light-like, space-like, and time-like cases. Of course, the important ones physically are the light-like and the time-like, not so much space-like. So we might ask, how do we come up with a notion of straightest in curved space-time? We will, of course, see that the geodesics defined by these extremal properties of the action are also the same ones that are defined by the straightness condition in curved space as well as flat. Another reason why we need something like this, which is sort of self-evident, is that we want to do analysis. We need to differentiate things. You can't write down even non-relativistic classical physics without being able to differentiate functions on space-time or space. And so we need to be able to differentiate functions, but not only scalar functions, which we've learned, we've seen how to do using the gradient operator, but we not only need to differentiate scalar functions, but we need to differentiate vectors. And for that, we need, like in Maxwell's equations, for example, is a case where you need to differentiate vectors. Although, ironically enough, you can write Maxwell's equations without actually having the covariant derivative in curved space. But you can't write down, for example, the Lorentz force without having a notion of acceleration. So in order to define the notion of acceleration, we'll need, in an intrinsic way, we'll need something like covariant derivative. If you remember, we actually did come up with, when we derived the geodesic equation, I wrote down some expression and I said, we'll call this an acceleration. But it was all done with respect to a particular coordinate system. And I didn't check that it actually defined in a coordinate and independent way, that it actually defined a vector. So we'll now see why it does, again, from the discussion of covariant derivative. So the notion of acceleration, of course, also, when I say straightest curve, that means one whose acceleration is zero. That'll be the definition. The instantaneous acceleration is zero. So that's another reason why we need this. Lorentz force, also Killing's equation, which is the equation that I haven't said what this means, but it's an equation for what's called a Killing vector. That's most nicely written using the covariant derivative. Equations of geodesic deviation, which describe the tidal forces that act on freely falling particles, for example. All these involve somehow the covariant derivative. And later on, if we want to write the wave equation down, which looks very familiar, the scalar wave equation, for example, then this box operator has the same definition in curved space. If you write it as a formula, it looks like the same definition, but the derivative that enters here has to be the covariant derivative. So for all these different reasons, it's important to define this. When I was sort of preparing this, I almost convinced myself that we could actually postpone this and do all of the perihelion precession and bending of light and so on without even ever mentioning the covariant derivative. And that's true, but I think maybe it's ubiquitous, it comes up all the time in almost everything you see, it's probably good to define it as soon as possible. The way we could do it would be by working from the action principle, which is, action principles tend to be very powerful in situations of high symmetry, and of course, the Schwarzschild metric, which is a good approximation to the sun's metric because the sun is so round, is one of high symmetry. So how do we differentiate vectors? How do we, given a vector field, which depends on location in space-time, in technical language, it's a section of the tangent bundle. Some words you might hear, but basically it's just a tangent vector at every point of space-time. How do we differentiate it? How do we take its gradient, so to speak? And in order to do that, if you think about the meaning of derivative just asks you to compare things at very nearby, sort of infinitesimally nearby points, neighboring points, take their difference, sort of divide through by the distance, roughly speaking. That'll give you a directional derivative in any case. And we had the more fancy way of thinking about derivative as a linear operator that corresponds to partial derivatives. But in any case, the crucial step that you have to be able to do is to compare the object that you're trying to differentiate at different points of the manifold. And because the tangent spaces at different points of a manifold are just different spaces, right? There's no, just given the manifold itself, there's no God-given way to compare tangent vectors at different places. You can only do it if you have some sort of auxiliary information that allows you to make the comparison. And the first, both of these notions of derivative come from some auxiliary information. This one, the covariant derivative, uses information from the metric, which, if you like, is physically using information from the equivalence principle. And this other one, the Lie derivative, uses information that the Lie derivative is actually always taken with respect to a vector field, and it's using the extra information associated with the vector field to allow you to make the comparison. So you can't really compare at any 2 points, but if their 2 points lie on the same curve, integral curve of the vector field, then they can be compared, as we'll see. So let's start with this one, the covariant derivative. How do we compare the vectors at different points? The answer is, again, we use what I called the momentary inertial reference frame. This is one way of stating it, which the equivalence principle guarantees to us. The equivalence principle, in some sense, is the statement that there are these momentary inertial reference frames given any point, any space-time point. So of course, as you know, it's a reference frame made of freely falling particles that have, at least at that moment, zero acceleration. But we also saw the equation, so let's consider freely falling particles. We saw the equation in a coordinate chart, we saw the equation for a geodesic, which was something like d squared. Actually, is this how we had it? Did I use proper time there? I can't remember now. I think we did use proper time. Okay. Just remind you of this equation. This was the equation where these Christoffel symbols were some particular combinations of the metric coefficients and their derivatives. So freely fall, this was the what we called the acceleration, and the equation for the geodesic was precisely that this acceleration would vanish. But in a inertial frame, we just said that by definition it's one in which the acceleration is zero. So if we're in the inertial frame, that must mean that these are zero. And this is the, just to remind you, this is the well-known statement that if you regard these as the components of the gravitational field, because they're the ones that govern, well, because of this equation, basically, then this is the statement that in an inertial frame, the gravitational field vanishes. That's another way of stating the equivalence principle. And it's the, in particular, but it must be said that the inertial, that this equation can only hold at one point. So it's only in the infinitesimal neighborhood, so to speak, of any selected point that you can hope for this equation. But at that given point, you can. So if the equivalence principle is really right, so to speak, if we accept the equivalence principle, then we should be able to find at any point a set of coordinates in which this vanishes, and that'll represent the inertial reference frame. Also, if you can check this if you want, that this is equivalent, the statement that this vanish is equivalent to the statement that the, remember, this was just some linear combination of derivatives of the metric tensor components. And so if that vanishes, then of course the Christoffel symbols, the quote-unquote gravitational field, will vanish. But conversely, you can check that if this vanishes, these must also vanish. So we can ask for it in that form. We can say that the equivalence principle, that's it. Certainly, if we find such a frame in which this vanishes, then we've found a frame in which the Christoffel symbol vanishes, and that can be regarded as an inertial frame, and then we can compare vectors in that frame. That's the idea behind the definition that we're going to give. So what we'll actually look for is a set of coordinates in which the metric coefficients are momentarily constant. Their first derivative vanishes. It's never going, in general, it will not be possible to make the second derivative vanish. So the inertial frame can exist only to first order, so to speak. So this is what should be able to happen if the equivalence principle is not misleading us. But does it really happen, right? Does such a chart really exist, a coordinate chart? Because we've set up the mathematics now of what are differentiable manifolds, what are Lorentzian manifolds, manifolds with metrics. Everything is there. It would be very awkward if we had to add a further condition on all of them that said, well, they must be such that the metric must be such that at every point I can find such a frame in which its first derivatives vanish. So we should add, if we've captured correctly, if our notion of Lorentzian manifold with Lorentzian metric, and tangents, if that's correctly captured the idea of the equivalence principle, as I claimed it did, then it should be a theorem that such a chart exists at every point. So that's what we, fortunately there is. So let's prove that theorem. So let's consider some point P in the manifold M, and I'll adopt these coordinates at which x mu at P, I'm gonna take that to be the origin of the coordinate system, and I'll introduce a notation, which is this. I don't know the name of this symbol, but in another context, I would read it as isomorphic to, but I don't know what it is here, a name for it. But anyway, this symbol will mean equal at P, right? So equal at that special point at which we're looking for the inertial coordinates. So we're seeking a set of, so this is some arbitrary coordinate chart in the neighborhood of P. And we're seeking coordinates, which I'll call Y alpha, such that this holds. Okay, so if I put here in Y, if I put the metric in terms of the coordinate system Y, then it should be that its first derivative vanishes. Later we'll see, so this is a sort of very hands-on calculational way that we're going to arrive at the notion of covariant derivative. Later on we'll see a bunch of simple properties that the covariant derivative has, axioms if you like, which uniquely characterize it. So you can also go from that direction. So what is it that we're trying to what we're trying to solve is this. Let me remind you, I think we've seen this formula at least once before, this derivation. So this is if we consider the line element that goes along with this metric, as I mentioned before, now I'm just going to stop bothering with these parentheses around the concrete indices, and after a while, probably not bother with the distinction between the indices, not bother to use different kinds of letters for the different kinds of indices. So if I ask, what are the components of the, if I ask to rewrite the line element in these y coordinates, what do I have? Mu, nu, alpha, beta, dy alpha, dy beta, right? This is just expanding out the line element in the other coordinate system. This, of course, is the metric and the y-coordinate, so I'll call it, to distinguish it from the metric expressed in the x-coordinates, I'll call it g hat, and it'll be g hat sub alpha beta of y. Okay, so that's the relation between the two. Familiar, probably familiar to everyone, I think. So if I write it out, if I take the derivative of that equation that says that g hat is equal to this expression, if I just differentiated it with respect to y alpha now, what I have is partial g hat alpha beta, partial y gamma, I guess. I just have to differentiate the three terms. So the first term is partial g mu nu of x. Maybe now I can leave it like that. Partial y gamma, partial x mu. The other I just copy there. Partial y, partial x, partial y mu. Now I'm going to introduce a symbol, a shorthand symbol, which is, and it's just a it's just to save me writing two terms. So by this, I mean symmetrize on alpha and beta. So I'll just get g mu nu partial squared x mu, partial y alpha, partial y gamma, right? Whoops. I used the other, I chose to differentiate the other one. Well, it doesn't make any difference, so I'm going to symmetrize. So partial x nu, partial y beta, okay. Where this here, this here means symmetrize on alpha beta. When I say symmetrize, it means write the thing and then exchange alpha and beta and add it. So in other words, I'm not including any factor of a half. So the kind of way this notation is meant to work would be if we have some sort of, I don't know how to write it, but something that depends on alpha and beta, it just means this thing as it is originally, plus the same thing with beta and alpha exchanged. That's okay. So the thing to notice now is that this first term is, I'll give it a name, g alpha beta gamma. It's automatically, as you can see, symmetric because g is symmetric on mu and nu. This is automatically symmetric on alpha and beta. So this is already symmetric here. And the second term, which I'll call, before the symmetrization, I'll call t alpha beta gamma. Oh, now it isn't. Now it does matter which way I wrote it. Nuts. I don't want that. Is that right? Yes, okay. So this thing I'll call T alpha beta gamma. And so this symmetrization just means T alpha beta gamma plus T beta alpha gamma. But notice that because there's two derivatives here, they're just partial derivatives in a coordinate sense, they commute so that this is symmetric also on gamma and the second two indices. So this allow, and we want, of course, we want this whole thing to equal zero. That was the condition. We wanted the metric in the y coordinates to have zero derivative. So we're trying to solve this equation. And these symmetry properties allow you to use a trick and to solve it fairly directly. So let's write this equation out again. It says that 0 is equal to g using this simplified, this more compact notation to avoid writing all this out. It's g alpha beta gamma. Now I'll write out explicitly what the symmetrization meant, plus t alpha beta gamma plus t beta alpha gamma. Okay, that has to equal 0. So it turns out, because of the symmetry, that you can deduce from that the relationship between g alpha beta. I mean, this equation, as it's written, so to speak, solves. It gives you g in terms of t, but we can invert it and get t in terms of g, just by playing with the indices. But now I should be careful to write this, right? It's only actually at that special point at p, basically, that we're demanding this equation to hold. So the trick is to make just cyclic permutations. Just write these equations 3 times. And make cyclic permutations of the indices so it becomes beta gamma alpha, and this becomes beta gamma alpha, and this one becomes gamma beta alpha, I guess, hopefully, and then this one becomes gamma alpha beta, this one becomes gamma alpha beta, and this one becomes alpha gamma beta, I hope. Okay. And then combine these with a plus. Notice that both of these have what we're interested in, which is T alpha beta gamma. This one looks like T alpha gamma beta, but remember, T is symmetric in its second and third indices. So take these with a plus sign, and then take this with a minus sign, and it turns out miraculously that everything cancels out that you didn't want to have there. So in particular, remember that this is symmetric in its second and third indices. These are equal because they, in the first index, they're the same, so they cancel. And then the same for these, they start with gamma, so they cancel. And we're left with T alpha gamma beta twice. So the statement is then that the sum of these three with those signs gives you twice T alpha beta gamma. So in other words, T alpha beta gamma is equal to 1/2 minus 1/2. Of this sum here, because these sum to 0. So if we solve it for t, yeah. So alpha gamma, gamma alpha beta, it should be. Minus g beta gamma alpha. Did I write the wrong thing? Yes, I did write the wrong. Okay, so now let's just check. So the claim is that this is the solution. What have we got? We've got this object, whatever it is, in terms of this object, which involves the derivatives of the metric tensor at that point y, at that point p, sorry, let's check that it's a solution. So if it's a solution, what this equation said is that if we symmetrize T alpha beta gamma on its first two indices, then we get minus and add to it G, this capital G alpha beta gamma, we get zero. So let's check that. So T, this alpha beta T I'll try to be careful that I'm only asserting this at that point P, which is the zero of the coordinate systems. So if we symmetrize this on alpha and beta, then what do we get? We get minus 1/2. We'll get G alpha beta gamma symmetrized. I need to symmetrize. I'll use the same S to always represent the symmetrization, plus G gamma alpha beta symmetrized minus G minus the symmetrization of G gamma alpha beta. Okay. So, oh no. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So now, if we so notice this original G, that was symmetric in its first two indices. So by symmetrizing it, all I do is produce a factor of 2. So it's equal to minus, and then that cancels the 1/2. So it's equal to minus G alpha beta gamma. However, these two, if you look at them, they both have gamma in the first place. The first site, I don't know. Anyway, their first index is gamma in both cases. And now they only differ by the order of the second two indices. But if we symmetrize it, that difference goes away. So therefore, they cancel each other. So that checks. That checks the equation that we wanted. So this does solve it. And now, yeah, I guess this is okay. So now I claim that we can find the desired coordinate system. Or we can, if you like, we can prove that the coordinate system exists. So this thing that we're looking for, these y alphas, do exist. And why is it? First of all, how would we find them from this? First of all, we have to, if we wanted to totally define the coordinate system, we only care for it in the neighborhood of the point P. So first of all, we're going to assume that Y alpha at P, just for convenience, is zero. We already did assume that, I think. So Y alpha, in other words, if I now think of what I want to do is think of the Y's as a function of the X's. So in other words, what I'm assuming is that y alpha when x equals 0 is 0. What I'm doing here is expanding out the y's. I'm going to get them as a sort of power series in the x's. So the first thing is just trivial that we set it to be 0. Second of all, we need to get dy alpha dx mu, let's say, again at the origin. So what do I choose for that? Doesn't matter. Right? So I can choose anything I like for that. Once I've got that, so now comes the non-trivial step. Once I've got the partial derivatives of y with respect to x, and I know g mu nu at x, so actually, this equation now is only meant to hold at the origin anyway. So I can put here 0, and I could put here 0 for the equation that we're interested in. But anyway, once I have the partial derivatives of y with respect to x, I can invert it, and that'll give me the partial derivative of x with respect. That'll give me partial derivative of x with respect to y. So I've chosen this freely. That means that its inverse is also free. Okay. And so that, so I know what it, I choose this as I like, basically, and that tells me I can then solve this equation knowing T alpha beta gamma, which I have here. I can solve this equation for, so that's the equation. So we solve the equation that T alpha beta gamma equals whatever that is, oops, G mu nu times partial X mu, partial alpha, partial Y alpha, partial squared X nu, partial Y gamma, partial Y alpha. I solve that equation for the second derivative here. I have too many alphas here. Something. This was supposed to be a beta. Yeah. I solve this equation for the second derivative. Okay, because I know G mu nu, and this thing can be inverted. I mean, this is just sort of like a matrix equation. If you just think about it, if I apply the inverse matrix here, I'll get rid of this, and then if I apply the inverse of G mu nu, I'll get rid of that, and I'll be left with this. So this equation can be solved for partial squared x, partial for the second derivatives of y with respect to x. But once I have those, once I choose them appropriately, then from the very top equation, it will be the case, because that was the equation I solved, it will be the case that we're done. In other words, it will be the case then that g hat of partial y will equal zero. That's what we were aiming to solve. So what have we done? We've adjusted, basically, I've only told you I haven't yet given you the y coordinates. All I've given you is their value, their first derivatives, and their second partial, and their second, where are they? Oh, actually what I gave you here were the second partial derivatives of x with respect to y. So that was not a cheat, but I left out a step. Once you know the second partial derivatives of x with respect to y, so I should have put in here probably a 4, which was 4, find the second partial derivatives of y with respect to x from what we do know, which we just from 3, which is this, the opposite. Okay. So when you know the partial derivatives of something with respect to something else and the first derivatives, you can also deduce from it the inverse thing, the partial derivatives of the first, second with respect to the first. Okay. Whatever I said, it might have not been the right words, but you know what I mean. We, from knowing these partial derivatives, we can get these partial derivatives. So I won't bother to write that out explicitly. And then once we do that, then we know y to second order. We've got its value, its first derivatives, and its second derivatives. And then, well, you could just stop there. It doesn't matter. You could just say that its higher derivatives all vanish. Or you could choose them in any way you like. The simplest might be to say that its highest derivatives all vanish, and then just write it out as the polynomial that it has to be, in order to have those zeros, first and second derivatives. So that'll give an example of a coordinate system that's inertial at that point P. So that ends the proof. Let me just draw a picture to say, sort of, what have we done? What we've really done is determined a chart at a higher precision than a general chart would have. So here's our manifold, here's some region within it, say, and here's, say, the point P, and some little neighborhood of P where we're going to define our chart, and over here is our chart vector space, which we've taken, since we're using a coordinate chart, we've taken it to be R4, but we've used more. What the equivalence principle tells us, in some sense, is not only that we can take it to be R4, in other words, a vector space, but it also tells us that it has metric information. Just as we discussed when we were talking about the metric tensor, this actually comes with a flat metric, which we usually call A to mu nu. So really, we've said that this, we can imagine this vector space here to be Minkowski space, not that locally space-time is like Minkowski space. It's not just like any old vector space. It has a distinguished metric. And all we've done is, and here's our chart map. All we've done is really determined this chart map to second order from the condition that the metric match up here with the metric matching up here. In other words, we've arranged that, so I'll introduce a new notation, which you'll see a lot. Okay. So this is the so-called pullback. This is just, remember, we had this thing that I wrote with the lower star, which mapped vectors here to vectors here. By mapping vectors here to vectors here, I can also map tensors here, covectors here to covectors here, tensors here to tensors here. And I could use the same notation for it. But here, I've used the notation that you'll probably see more often with covectors, which is the so-called pullback. So this is just that same map run in the other direction. It turns out that it's easy. Well, I won't go into it now, but it turns out that it's, when you're dealing with forms, so-called forms, covectors, and so on, even if your map is not a diffeomorphism like it is here, you can always run it backwards, but you can't always run it forward in that case. That's why it's more traditional use that when to use this upstairs one when you're working with covariant objects. So this is the so-called pullback. I mean, not the star, but this whole map is the pullback, this C star. So anyway, all it's saying in words is that you take the metric, the flat metric that exists on that chart vector space, and you transfer it back to the space-time using this chart map, in other words, the coordinate systems, and you get the metric that's actually there. But as we've probably implicitly discussed when we talked about the definition of the metric tensor, but what's special here is you not only get it back, but you get it back to the next order. You get it back to the higher order than just linear. You get it back to quadratic order in the whole neighborhood of this point. I mean, expanding about this point, you get it to higher accuracy. So that's all we've done. We found a chart that matches the metric to one higher order than you might have expected you could do. Okay, so any questions on any of that? Yeah. I think those are both the same statement. You mean, did this not have to be true? If it's a consistency check, then it means that it had to be true. So I don't know how to answer it. Since it is true, in the mathematical world, sort of whatever is true has to be true. But
so the equivalent, you use the equivalence principle to say that the line element could always be written as some matrix. And then once you have that, then you can derive the geodesic equation.
Right.
So then, once you have that, then you look at the form of the equation, and then you say the equivalence principle would have to say that those coefficients should always be able to vanish in some chart. So I'm saying that if that weren't true.
If that weren't true, we would say that the equivalence principle was violated in this theory that we've built. So I would say if we correctly captured the sense of the equivalence principle in setting up the formalism, then it had to be true. So you might say that the equivalence principle has two parts. First, it tells you, two implications mathematically. First, it tells you, like you just said, that the metric exists. But secondly, it tells you that there exist these special charts which match the geometry to second order and not just to first order. That's these inertial, locally inertial reference or momentarily inertial reference frames. So in some sense, the first part implied the second, I suppose you could, within this mathematical framework, you could probably say it that way. We only needed to impose mathematically the first, and the second followed automatically. Had this not worked out, then you'd have a kind of choice. You could say, well, somehow we messed up, or you could say we need a new mathematical framework, or you could say, well, the equivalence principle is wrong in the theory we're constructing, but hopefully, well, then I don't know what you, then you're very likely to have the problem, you know, that things won't, freely falling bodies won't follow the same geodesic. So you probably don't on the same path, so you probably don't have that choice. So you just have, you'd have to either construct a different framework or you'd have to limit this one. You'd have to say, well, I only consider, in addition to saying that I have a manifold with Lorentzian metric, I have a further restriction that there should always exist such a thing. That'll be some funny kind of differential equation, like an integrability condition, you might call it, that the metric has to satisfy. An analogy might be when you're trying to construct a complex structure on a manifold, for those who know what it means. You can't just have locally a notion of multiplication by I, but there's some sort of consistent sort of integrability condition that lets you choose complex coordinates in a whole neighborhood and not just at one point. So you might be able to go that way. But fortunately, I'm sure no one ever considered this issue because we don't have to do that in this case. Was there another question? No. Thought I saw a hand. Okay.
I was going to ask for clarification. When you said matching the second order, you mean something like, is something like the first derivatives match?
It was just words for what I just said. Yeah. Not that the first derivatives vanish, but the first derivatives of the difference vanish. In other words, I pulled back. Yeah, the first derivative of this difference. The first derivatives match. So that's in some sense second order. First order, what I was calling first order, is just saying that the metric themselves match, the metric tensors match. And now we're asking that their first derivatives match as well. So it's related, well, enough of that. So now we have it. The reason we've done this, by the way, this little calculation, it's not by accident. It might remind you of the calculation you have to do or that we did before to get the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric. It's in essence the same algebraic, the same thing, and obviously it's very closely related physically because we're using the Christoffel symbols, as we'll see, are more or less equivalent to the covariant derivative, and we use this to show that to define the covariant derivative. So what we want to do now is define the covariant derivative of a vector. Of course, the covariant derivative of a scalar, we already know what we should do for that. We'll just take it to be the gradient of the scalar, which we've already defined. But what we don't know is how, that's because you can compare scalars at neighboring points, any two points, in fact, without needing anything special, like a metric. But in order to compare vectors at different points, you do need something special. Once we can do that, then we can compare anything, covectors, tensors, because they all follow from the rule for comparing vectors, also known as parallel transport of vectors, as we'll see. So consider any special chart, like we had this momentarily geodesic chart y alpha at p. So now I want to define the covariant derivative of this vector. So how do I do it? If you think through what we've just done, the natural thing is, I don't want this dot here, it's just some smudge. The natural thing is to just work, go into that coordinate system and take partial derivatives. In that coordinate system, it's as if it was flat. This is now a vector space, and we just differentiate. In vector spaces, you can compare. Or if you like, in a coordinate system, you can compare. You say vectors are equal if they have the same components in this coordinate system. So here's a formula for doing that. So we'll say that the coordinates of the covariant derivative are the ordinary derivatives of the components of the covariant derivative are the ordinary derivatives of the components of the vector in that coordinate system. Here's a formula that says that. It says that the covariant derivative of VB, so I go into that coordinate system, so I have the vector V, I take its components, which we know we do by this, by contracting it. Corresponding to these coordinate system, I have the basis vectors and covectors E alpha, mu, et cetera, E alpha, A, et cetera. So I'm working with that basis that belongs to that coordinate system. And then these are the components. Then I take their derivatives, which is partial Y alpha in that coordinate. And then those are the components of this. So I have to transform this back now into, I want on the left-hand side, I want a tensor. So these are the components of that tensor. So to get it back as a tensor, of course, I use this inverse of the rule for taking components, the so-called completeness relation, I guess, basically. And that says, beta B, okay? So this expresses, and again, let me write this to emphasize that it just holds at P, write it like this. So this is our rule for this is our definition of the covariant derivative. I can actually simplify it a little bit more because this combination, if I contract this alpha with this alpha, I mean, if I look what it means to contract this basis covector with that partial derivative, remember that's just the gradient operator. So what this is actually equal to is just partial A of this stuff here, and then multiplied by EB beta. So it's a slightly simpler formula. So that's going to be our formula for that's our definition of the covariant derivative. Okay, so it's partial A of E beta C V C E V beta. Okay. So what did I do? I used the coordinate system, the special inertial coordinate system, to get a special basis at each point, a basis vector and covector for the tangent space. Then I used that basis to get scalars. Then I took the gradient of the scalar, which I know how to do, and then I used the basis again to convert that vector back into the components of the vector back into a vector. Okay? So that's the definition. Oops, I started with the wrong. Oh no, this is right. So, some people look puzzled, but if you think about it, I think then you'll see it matches the words that I said. This is just a fancy way or clever way of writing down that tensor whose components are the partial derivatives of the components of V in that special coordinate system or in that special basis, EA. E, B, which one, this one or this one?
The top one.
The top one. It might be because I made a mistake with the indices. No, this is all right. So this here is just a matrix. It's got two indices, alpha and beta, just an array of numbers. Those are meant to be the components of this tensor. So now I have to ask, which tensor has these components? And the way I get that is I throw, you know, I multiply by these basis vectors and covectors and sum. I mean, these are the expansion. To say that these are the components of some tensor means that when I expand the tensor in terms of the basis vectors and covectors, they're the expansion coefficients. That's all that's being written here. So what about now? What about more generally tensors, B, C, sort of D, E, for any tensor? Well, we just, so this is now an arbitrary tensor. We'll just use the same definition, exactly the same. I won't bother to write it out, but what it means is the same thing. Find the components of that tensor, and take their partial derivatives in that system of coordinates, and then let that be the components of a new tensor that has one more covariant index, and that we call the covariant derivative. Okay, so if I write that out in, I said I won't write it out fully, but I could say that this is, I can write it out slightly more fully. How will it will look? It's just schematically. It'll look exactly like this, only with a tensor in place of V. We'll take again, we'll form, oops, no, I left out the E's that I need. We'll contract with the E's, E, a bunch of E's and a bunch of different sorts with the right indices. To get numbers, I'll take the gradient of those numbers, and then I'll take a bunch of E's of the matching type to go back, anyway, to go back to the tensors. Okay. So the formula will look like this. Now this is equivalent. I didn't have to say that. I could have said, we could just assume that the Leibniz rule holds. I never can remember how to spell Leibniz, whether it has a T, does it have a T or not? Anyway, assume that it holds for the tensor product and commutes with contraction, or it holds with commutes with contraction, I guess would be the right way of saying it. In other words, all I'm saying here is that once we know how to take derivatives of vectors, since we can form, then we know covectors. We'll see that in a second. And then we know tensor products because we can just apply the derivative separately to each factor in the tensor product. What this hasn't shown, however, is that the resulting, I've given a definition here, but what I haven't proved, well, in fact, this definition I've given with respect to a coordinate system, so a special class of coordinate systems, which are those which are momentarily inertial. In fact, all I really used in the definition, as you can see, are the basis vectors and covectors associated with that coordinate system. So I can this will be useful later. I can actually define this for any distinguished basis that I have on the manifold. But in this case, it's a coordinate basis. But what I haven't shown is that this definition is independent of my choice of inertial, momentarily inertial frame, right? I mean, that's not the only, in fact, we saw when we were solving for it, that there's some freedom, because remember here, I had the freedom to choose this arbitrarily. So you might, I guess you might look at this and already understand that it is independent, because this is only a linear transformation. It's only, so it's not going to mess up these relations. I suppose that's, you could probably make that argument, but let me make it in a slightly different way. So now I want to prove the independence. And the way, this is useful because it gives a deeper insight, I think, into the geometric meaning of what we're doing in defining the covariant derivative. Well, it's a different kind of insight. This gives the kind of insight that it comes from the equivalence principle, but this will give you a more directly useful way of thinking about it for many purposes. What you don't want to do is always have to go back to these special inertial coordinate systems. So this other way is what I mentioned before, which is to characterize this covariant derivative operation by its formal properties. So first of all, and then I'm going to tell you some properties that it has, and then we'll show that anything, any two things that have those properties are equal. And we'll show that, and we've just seen that, we'll see in a second, that if it's defined in this way with respect to any momentarily inertial coordinates, then it will have these properties. So then that'll prove independence of the choice of coordinate system. So just to be impartial, I'll spell it the other way. So it's linear, it obeys the Leibniz condition. That follows either by definition or just trivially from the fact that partial derivatives obey the Leibniz condition. So you've just converted, you converted this to a bunch of numbers, and you took, which are, as we saw before, when you take the tensor product of two tensors and ask what does that look like in terms of the components, it's just the products of their components. And then for products of numbers, the Leibniz rule works. And so the Leibniz rule is, you can check these things for yourself, is built into this definition. And it also commutes with contraction, right? But that's not all. It's also this in the box. It tells you, of course, the derivative of. As a special case, I could take this tensor to be a scalar, and then it just tells you that I have the gradient in the normal sense. There are no more of these e's and e inverses. We said that already, anyway, that we will define the gradient of. As a special case, we've defined the gradient of the scalar to just be the covariant derivative of the scalar. And then, and here's the crucial one, that the covariant derivative of the metric tensor itself is zero, right? Why is that? Because that's sort of the whole point of what we did. We defined the covariant derivative so that at p in the special coordinates, it looks like partial derivative, but we defined those partial derivatives by the condition that in those special coordinates again, the partial derivatives of the metric are again zero at that special point. So of course, again, of course, we get this fact at the point P. But then if it's true at the point P, P was any point, so it's true everywhere. But here's one that's not as obvious. In fact, maybe I'll make it a homework. So you're used to the fact that partial derivatives commute with each other. Unfortunately, there's no such luck for the covariant derivative. When you commute the covariant derivative, when you take it twice and switch the order, you don't get zero in general. In fact, what you get, and that's one way, the nicest way of defining what the Riemann tensor is. It's the correction to, it's what you do get when you commute. So I could write this in another way. This was the anti-symmetrization symbol, but why don't I just write it like this? The commutator. Okay. This is in fact true in the, if you think in terms of the Christoffel symbols, this is the statement that they're symmetric in their lower indices. In a more fancy language, it says that the torsion, it says that what's called the torsion is zero. So it says that the covariant derivative, maybe I didn't use this word, is torsion free. In fact, another word, I think I should have put this before, but I'll put it now. This also has a name, which is sort of applied either to the Christoffel symbol or to the covariant derivative or to anything equivalent to it. It's called the connection. Connection meaning that thing which allows you to do parallel transport. That's just another terminology that you'll run across, which I was about to use. So this says that the connection is torsion-free. Anyway, so it's the statement then that although the covariant derivatives don't commute in general, they do commute when they're applied to a scalar. So that's an important thing. These are the formal properties. The claim will now be any covariant derivative operator which has these properties is the same one we just produced. In other words, that these properties uniquely characterize the covariant derivative. By the way, if you isolate these three properties, they have a name which you'll run across a lot in connection with differential geometry, which is they're a derivation. We saw that word before when we said that one way that people sometimes think about a vector field is as a derivation on the space of scalar fields. Here, this is a derivation on the space of tensor fields. That's just a terminology. Okay, so now I claim that these determine, or let's say characterize, the covariant derivative. So in other words, if I have any two covariant derivatives that satisfy this, then they must be the same one. So in order to prove that, we can prove a slightly more general thing that's quite useful to know, which is that, so we're now trying to prove uniqueness. We're going to prove, in order to prove, well, so we'll introduce a second, we'll imagine two such covariant derivative operators, the one that we actually defined up there, let's cover it up now, I guess, and the one, and some other one, that came from somewhere else. We don't know anything about it except that it satisfies these conditions. We want to show that the difference between those two is zero, okay? So this would be zero. In order to prove that, it's very useful to know how to characterize the difference between two covariant derivatives. And the thing that we're about to prove now is that the difference between any two covariant derivatives is given by a tensor. It's just a tensor. So the claim, what's called a lemma, is that for any two, well, so I have to state this carefully, let grad A and grad A bar any two blah, 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 things which satisfy this. I'll just call them connections. That satisfy I don't even need the above, so I need, well, I guess I just, it's just the first three that I need, so it's the derivation conditions. Furthermore, remember we defined these from a basis, so let there be such a basis such that, of the type we used in the definition, that its covariant derivative with respect to the first one equals zero. Oops. At a given point. So this means at some point P. We won't, in general, be able to find a basis for which this is true everywhere unless the space-time is flat. So this could be, so here we could just think of the y basis that we just, or the y coordinate and the associated basis that we just derived. Then the claim is, I won't state the conclusion will be that, well, I'll write it out in full in a second, but I'll just put it in, quotes here to see what it'll look like. It'll tell us that the difference between the two operators is given by a tensor, C, which we'll see in a second, how that goes. So by this calculation. Also, I wanted to make a comment. I claimed that any two connections differ by a tensor, but here I made what looks like maybe an extra assumption, is that the connection there should exist a basis which is no momentarily constant at any given point P. So you might wonder that whether that's an extra assumption. It's not, given, as we'll see when we discuss parallel transport, that given any covariant derivative operator, you can always find a basis which to first order is constant, even if it has torsion or whatnot. Anyway, that won't be the important case. In the important application, we already know that there exists such a basis because that's how we define the covariant derivative. So now let's do a little calculation using the same trick of inserting one and then using that to bring in basis vectors. So this is grad AVC now, right? Now I write that identity operator in terms of basis vectors. In our special basis. Okay. Grad ABC. But because it is that special basis, I can pull the second basis vector or covector inside the gradient. Now we do a trick. So it looks like we're just unpacking, going back to the definition we had before. But now we do something tricky. This is true. This is all true. See, everything I've written so far is true in general, but at this well, in fact, I don't even need this. Somewhere I'm going to need this thing. Let's see, maybe I don't need this. Okay, it says, catch me if you think I've stated something too strong. But anyway, this is just now the gradient of some scalar, right? So I can write EB, I guess I don't need to write that. Funny equal sign. since it's the gradient by one of the general properties of the definition of a connection or a covariant derivative, this is true whether or not, I mean, I could put here even this symbol, but so it's certainly true for all covariant derivatives. So I swap this, so I here I've switched from the covariant derivative we started with to this other one that we're trying to compare with. And now I just undo everything. And so it's equal to E V beta. Now I just expand it out and I get, if I let the derivative act on the second thing, I'll get on the V there, I'll get E beta C grad A V C. And then if I let it act on the E, I'll get plus EB beta covariant derivative of the second type. BC. This, of course, equals, and this collapses to the delta function that we started with, E delta BC, and we just get grad A VB. Okay. But in doing this trickery, we've been generated another term, which is just this term here. But why did I not write it out again? I'll give this a name of C B C A. And the order is only important if you're dealing with torsion. But so for us, it won't really be. Well, it can become important, yeah. And so let's freeze the order this way. And so you see what. So that's the conclusion. That was the desired conclusion. So we found that the difference. Something went wrong here. I forgot the bar. Okay. So we see that the difference, we started with the covariant derivative with respect to the first connection, and then we rewritten it as the covariant derivative with respect to the second connection plus a correction term. So the formula then says that, just to write it out, what we've learned is that the difference between these two acting on an arbitrary vector field B is given by C B C A times B C. Okay. I won't bother to write out again what C is, but its definition is here. It's some tensor which you can get if you know the covariant derivative with respect to the second connection of the basis vectors that match the first connection, or vice versa. Okay, so is it clear? Yeah.
Can you repeat why you had
this step? Yeah, this is the key step here. This step here. The reason is that both of these are just equal to the ordinary gradient of this set of four numbers. So this is just four numbers, right? If I set beta equal to zero, then it's the zeroth component of the vector V in that basis and so on. So to take the gradient of a number, so I'm using the formula that if I have any scalar, it doesn't matter in which covariant derivative I use, they always just give the ordinary gradient of that scalar. So the reason is that both of them are equal to the gradient of those of the same scalar. What have I used? So I used Leibniz, I used the contraction all over the place. And I've used this, yes. So that's right. You're right, I should have said, that's a good point. Well, to me, that's part of the definition of a connection, actually. So remember when we first started, I said, for starters, we'll just say that the covariant derivative of a scalar is just its gradient. So it's definitely used this, yes. You're right, I could just say in a sense, I could leave this out because it's part of the definition of the connection.
But,
yeah.
In the Einstein-Cartan theory, you have torsion. So there, the covariant derivative doesn't have torsion there. I mean,
yes.
Okay, so if any connection satisfies the first three properties, it cannot have torsion.
No, it can. Here's the condition that says it has no torsion. And in fact, yeah, that's right. So certainly these do not imply that it lacks torsion. And in fact, even though we won't be dealing with connections with genuine torsion, we will be dealing, it can happen, and it's very common to use Christoffel symbols that have an asymmetry. And that comes about when you use a so-called anholonomic basis. Remember we talked about there two natural sets of bases, the coordinate bases and the orthonormal bases. And it's very common to use orthonormal bases. And then you get sort of analogs of the Christoffel symbol. For us, they really are Christoffel symbols in the way I've defined them. And they need not be symmetric, even though the underlying geometric connection is still torsion-free. It's because you used a basis that wasn't a coordinate basis. So we'll see. So even without torsion, you can have a kind of Christoffel symbol that's not symmetric. Yeah.
Sorry, never mind.
Okay. So I guess I just want to give a name. Now what do I... Oh, no. I think I have to go back. Yeah. So we were trying to prove... So let's finish up now and prove the actual theorem that we wanted, which is just that these conditions completely determine the metric. So let's apply this, sorry, the connection. So now let's apply this. Well, here's the formula already. Let's apply it to the case at hand, which is, So this tells you the difference between the two connections applied to a vector. Then you need also a formula for the difference of two connections applied to a covector, and so on, applied to a tensor in general. So I just say what it is now. I mean, this just follows from, I mean, I could go through the same derivation using a covector. I could also go through it using a tensor, the notation would become kind of painful, but you could do it for that too. Or you can just use the fact that you know that when you contract a scalar tensor, when you contract a vector with a covector, you get a scalar, and we know how to take covariant derivatives of scalars, and that'll determine covariant derivatives of covectors in terms of vectors and so on. Anyway, the consequence of all that, this is just what I wanted to mention, because we'll need it in a second, is if we take the difference between these two connections and apply it to a covector, so let's say omega b, you'll get exactly the same object coming in here, except now it's got a, b, c, omega c, and because you want the covariant, because the difference has to go away when you contract the covector with the vector, there has to be a minus sign there. You get a minus sign. So that's the formula for the difference of these two applied to a covector. And then for a tensor, it follows each index will bring in a term like this where you contract the C with the appropriate index of the... you contract the appropriate index of the C with the index that you're working with. In this case, it's this index. If it was if it was a covector, then it's like here, it's this index, and then there's the extra free index that represent that corresponds to the derivative itself. Okay, these formulas I think you're familiar with because you've seen exactly the same formulas, probably just using the Christoffel symbol here instead of a tensor. The difference here is that this is a tensor that's giving the difference of two covariant derivatives. And in fact, the one is really a special case of the other. If you think of the Christoffel symbol as being the difference between two covariant derivatives, one which belongs to the flat metric of your coordinate system, and the other one is generic, then, or is the one that belongs to the curved, the true curved metric, then it's a then what I've written here specializes to the formula that you've probably seen involving the Christoffel symbols. Anyway, I don't think I said it very clearly, but hopefully you see what I mean. So once we know how to apply to covariant indices, now let's apply this to the case, to the metric. We said, now we'll bring in this fourth or fifth condition, whatever it was, that these have to be equal because they both have to be equal to zero. So that means that if that means that the difference applied to this tensor is zero, and that means using this rule that we just gave here, so let's apply it to GAB. So we get C, let me see if I can do this, CBA, yes, GC, what about, oh, this has got to be a C. This is a C. I want to apply it to GAB. So this will be an A. Let's give this some other letter, M. Okay, if I got that right. Now I have to, that this came from applying, letting the active index be that A. Then I have to write the same thing just with A and B commuted. That has to equal zero, right? That's the statement that the difference of these two when applied to the metric gives zero. But this is, we have a notation for this. This is just to lower the index M. So I'll imagine it to come before the other two. So I'll write usually always in this order. Okay. So it'll become GBAC plus ABC equals zero. So if we just, in other words, if we take the C and anti-symmetrize it on its first two indices, which for short, or the other notation I was using was that anti-symmetrize, anyways, just this sum, that equals zero. But now we know something else. We make the same now we're usually torsion-free. Make the same calculation, but instead of putting G here, put phi here. We have to put 2. Sorry. So we'll use, never mind that. So we use G, the commutator applied to phi equals zero, which is the commutator of the bar. We'll be done in a second. I'll quit after this last line. If you work out what that says, that requires you to take the commutator. That's the anti-symmetrization with respect to A and B of grad A, grad B phi, which is equal to the anti-symmetrization of grad A partial B phi. Now we have to work out, now we want to take the difference. That has to equal zero. Now we want to do the same thing with, our other covariant derivative. That also has to equal zero. And so that means if I have to plug in C here, again, there's two terms. If you go through it, it's just two more steps or one more step. You get that C, A, In this case, it turns out you're anti-symmetrizing on the second, third, and second and third indices. That equals zero. So now we have learned that if we symmetrize on the first two indices, we get zero. And if we anti-symmetrize on the second two indices, we get zero. And I claim that that implies that C itself equals zero. So how can we see that? I think we can just leave it as an exercise, but I think it's actually a sort of cute calculation. So we're saying that CABC, if we symmetrize, we just swap the two indices in turn. If we swap the first two, then it equals BAC. If we swap the second two, we get a minus sign, BCA. If we now swap the first two, it's minus CCBA. If we now swap the second two, what have I... This may be, we have to do all that. Then we get another minus sign, CAB.
Yeah.
I have to swap. What do I have to do? The first two, CACB. And now a minus sign, I said ABC. All right, so I proved that CABC is minus CABC. So it must vanish. So no tensor can have this property that it's symmetric in the first two and anti-symmetric in the second two except zero. So that's the proof. So if we, all we've really done before, if we take this point of view as an existence proof, that there is at least one thing that satisfies all these conditions. And now we know that any other thing that satisfies these conditions is the same thing, it's the same covariant derivative. And therefore, it didn't matter how we got it, whether we use a different and momentary inertial frame or any other way, it's got to be the same.
I think you made two mistakes that have canceled.
That canceled out? Good. I'm glad that canceled out. In this calculation?
Yeah, so there should be a minus.
There's a minus sign.
The second
here.
One that you've written down. No.
This is okay.
No, it's the other one, right?
It's the first two there? No, the first two commute, the second two anti-commute.
So the very first equality, there should be a minus sign.
No, that's correct.
No.
Commute.
Oh, I see. I see, but everything is backward. That's
because
here I said that it was anti-symmetric in the first two, and here I said it was symmetric in the second. Well, anyway, if on any two indices it's symmetric and on any other two it's anti-symmetric, then it has to vanish, right? Thanks.